WBUR.
Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. In an age of specialization, it seems that Richard Russo is taking a big risk. You know him, the guy who writes about factory towns and blue-collar workers with the knowing humor of a man who must have punched a time clock or two himself. It resonates. He's undeniably successful. The movie of his novel, Nobody's Fool, starred Paul Newman, Bruce Willis, and Melanie Griffith. His latest expansive work, Empire Falls, won the Pulitzer. But his new book is a big change. In his collection of short stories called The Whore's Child, Rick Russo traded the pickup truck for a Volvo, where he told the tales of restaurant workers and handymen. He's exploring the unease of those who have it made. With the halogen glare of the short story, he illuminates the darker corners of their lives, self-important professors, huffy housewives, pampered cinematographers, and sheltered nuns are forced to examine their lives and admit that the biggest tricks played on them were perpetuated by themselves. Connection listeners, are you ready for your favorite epic novelist to turn his pen to a more curtailed form? Or do you worry over getting to know an old pal in a twin rather than a king size? And is the short story the best literary form for digging deep into hidden lives and human complexity? My guest today is Richard Russo, the author of Mohawk, The Risk Pool, Nobody's Fool, Straight Man, and Empire Falls, for which he won a Pulitzer Prize, and now The Horse Child. Richard Russo, it's very nice to see you here.
Hi, Jackie.
You know, one of my other favorite short story writers, the Irish writer Frank O'Connor, said that the short story form is for renegades, exiles, outlaws, and crazy. So where do you identify yourself in that group?
Oh, crazy. if I have to pick one of those.
Well, you're hardly in exile because you have always, I think, mined the vein of from whence you came. You're originally from Johnstown, Pennsylvania.
New York.
I'm sorry, Johnstown, New York. All right.
Yes, we were never flooded in Johnstown. The myriad other tragic things happened, but floods we managed to avoid some way or other.
Well, I don't want to say that all small mining towns are alike or all small mill towns are alike. But you have stuck with that, and you have made an epic landscape out of the small dimension.
Right.
In the past.
Right.
Why the change?
Well, actually, it isn't as much of a change as it looks like. I've been telling people that because this book follows Empire Falls in publication, it didn't necessarily follow it in the writing. I've been writing short stories for years. But it's taken me the better part of a decade or a little more, actually, to come up with a slender collection of short stories that this is. Some of the stories go back 10 or 12 years. Some of them, like the last story in this collection, The Mysteries of Linwood Heart, is very recent. But really, it's just taken all this time to, as you say, mine through my less successful efforts in the short story form and come up with a volume of stories, all of which I'm pleased to see reprinted in between cloth covers.
Well, that's interesting because one would think that it would be the big book that is harder and the slim story that's somewhat easier.
Well, and for many writers, that would be true. It's not the way my imagination works. I am a writer of, I suppose, if they were paintings, they would be murals. They're big. They're full of life and character and lots of digressions. And my imagination goes out rather than in, for the most part. These stories represent the relatively few times over the span of my writing career when I have been able to hold the reins tightly enough to keep something within whatever bounds I had planned for them. And there are several stories in here actually that were once part of novels that I've yanked out of my previous novels and turned into short stories in that fashion.
Isn't it good that nothing ever really gets lost? Just put it away.
That's right.
Work with it later.
Just don't, it's not lost. You just have no idea where it is.
That's right. Let's read from one, not the title story, if you would. You've got your book over there, mm-hmm. page 66. This story is called The Farther You Go. And are you there with me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. If you would start with the section that I've chosen, it says, No, Seriously, and introduce the story a little bit for us. Tell us who's who.
This is actually a story that was written some time ago, and it became my novel Straight Man. This was the first introduction, both mine and the readers, to the character who would become Hank Devereaux in that story. And in this short story, we have a man named Hank, who at the beginning of the story has just come out of the hospital having had prostate surgery. And his wife, not wanting him to overexert, as she puts it, they have a very large lawn, and so rather than have him out there pushing his push mower over this acre or so of grass that he would have to mow, she has bought him a riding mower. And as the story opens, Hank is seated atop that riding mower and contemplating the fact that he'd be much better off afoot, actually, than sitting upon this throbbing engine as he is mowing his lawn.
I winced right away.
Yes. Yeah. And this, we're partway through the story now in the section that I'm going to read. And Hank is talking with his son-in-law, Russell, with whom he is in conflict. No, seriously, Russell says. I suspect he doesn't know what serious means, though he's learning. Ever since last night, I've been trying to figure out some way to punish myself, and now I can leave the whole thing in your capable hands. You're about the most capable man I've ever met, Hank. I don't mind saying it's been a bitch competing with you. I can't think what to say to this, but I have to admit, now that I've heard him out, that it is funny. I know you won't I hope you won't misconstrue my running you out of town as not liking you, Russell. We both smile at that. Were you and Fay ever unhappy, he asks. Together or separately, I say. Together, he says. Sure, I say. He thinks about this for a minute. I bet that's not true, he says. I bet you're just saying it for one of your famous philosophical reasons, like happiness just isn't in the cards for human beings, the sort of thing guys like you say to college students in your late afternoon classes before you go home and spend a happy evening in front of the television. There is a curious mixture of wisdom and naivete in this observation, and it makes me even sadder to be putting Russell on a plane.
You know, I was just thinking that in your other novels, the protagonist would be the guy who's hired to mow the lawn. And here you've got, I don't recall if this guy's a retired professor, but he certainly can afford to employ someone to hire the lawn and help his daughter out. He's making them a loan to build a house. And there are many, many people. You've written about the middle class here in mm-hmm. this novel. Mm-hmm. A lot of them are academics. Excuse me, in this collection of short stories.
Right.
In this, see, I have to get used to thinking of you in that way. and I wonder what's behind the change.
Well, I've always been, and perhaps it does happen more in my short fiction now that I think about it. I mean, one of the things that's happened in my own life is that I have made this journey. Largely through education. I'm one of the first people in my family to get to get a college degree, and then mm-hmm. too many more degrees after that. And I've kind of educated myself into over the years different worlds than I typically write about in my novels. And it's these short stories, many of them are little forays into these other worlds. I've written Over the last few years, I've started writing screenplays, and so I've gotten to know a little bit more about that world. And there are a couple of stories in here that deal with one is about a screenwriter, and the other is about a cinematographer.
I love that.
And this man is an academic, which I've also done. I was a professor for a number of years before I hung up my mortarboard. So some of these stories represent, I suppose, the arc of my personal experience as well.
And in going through material for this, I read that it was actually a short story that really got you to identify yourself as a writer. I hadn't known that. Unless there's a great deal of misreporting always in the papers. Is that
yeah.
something you're
I'm
looking to
think,
bemused?
I'm trying to think. You know, writers...
A factoid someone unearthed long ago.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know where that would have come from. Writers who are on the road for long periods of time with novels begin making things up because the truth is insupportable to them. So I may have... Actually, the kind of seminal event in my writing career was I was writing an early draft of the novel that would become Mohawk.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in graduate school and very near the end of my graduate program in fiction writing. And I had given this novel to a friend of mine, a mentor, to read. And it was, I was living in Tucson, Arizona at the time, a big city. And during that time of my apprenticeship, I had been trying to write stories set in big cities, although I didn't know very much about them, and I was really, despite the fact that I'd lived there for a while, I was really a tourist in Tucson. I didn't really understand what made it work.
Mm-hmm.
So I had written this novel, and it was 450 pages or so, and gave it to this mentor who very kindly read it cover to cover. God bless him. I don't know how he managed, but he did. It was part of his
I would imagine he thinks it's a good investment
job.
Now.
But and he gave the book back to me, and he said, you know, he said, there are some good things here, but really there's really just one small part of this novel that really lives. And it's the part about your heroine in this book. It's the part when she was a girl. She hadn't messed up her life yet. And it took place in this small mill town in upstate New York. He said, that really lived. And it was, of course, the thing that I did not want to hear, because that was what I was trying to conceal. It was not what I was interested in. I didn't think I had, I didn't think anybody else would be interested in it. And to learn that the one thing, that I was hoping the other stuff would ring true, and it hadn't. And this one thing that I was more trying to escape than anything else was the only thing that was alive. So I went home and sulked for a while, sulking not so much because of what he said, but because I recognized the truth of what he said, and then went back and thought, well, if that's the only thing that's living, let's go with that. And it was a real watershed event.
Do you think that short stories lend themselves to themes that are bleaker, that are more full of desperation, that there's a kind of... we're going to ask our listeners there as well.
Well, I mean, the one thing nice about the short story is that if it is bleak, it's over in a hurry. The kinds of long novels that I write, if they were that bleak and they went on that long, I think we'd lose the vast majority of readers along the way.
All right, but we'll ask our readers and our listeners what they think about the short story form as it has been conveyed by the epic novelist, Richard Russo. The number to call is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Get in on the Richard Russo connection. The new book is called The Horse Child. It's a collection of short stories.
From Boston.
I'm Jackie Lydon. This is The Connection on National Public Radio. We're speaking in this hour with Richard Russo, a novelist who has come out with his first collection of short stories. Last year he won the Pulitzer for his epic novel, Empire Falls. This summer, a very different type of work, and we've been talking about the difference in compression as opposed to expansion. And you're going to read for us another one of these stories. This one is called Monhegan Light, right?
Yeah, this is a story that that investigates, among other things, notions of what really constitutes love, why and how do we love, and also has some fun with different notions of love as practiced on the west coast of the United States as opposed to that practiced on the east coast. And those come in contact as a result of a cinematographer named Martin, who is a gaffer, which means that he is the person who lights scenes in the movies. He is a man whose business is light. And he has traveled across the United States with his younger companion and lover to visit Monhegan Island off the coast of Maine, where he intends to visit a painter named Robert Trevor, whom he has just discovered has been surreptitiously over many years painting Martin's now deceased wife, Laura. So he's come to Monhegan Island, which has a lighthouse, to meet a man whose business is also light, a painter named Robert Trevor.
And he finds out about this earlier trespass, shall we say, through the painting that Trevor's created. Okay, thanks. All right, let you go ahead.
So, Robert, how long were you and my wife lovers? Trevor paused, deciding how best, or perhaps whether, to answer. Why would you want to know that, Martin? He said. How will knowing make anything better? How long, Robert? After a beat, the painter said, we had roughly 20 years' worth of summers. Right, Martin thought. The worst, then. Odd that he couldn't remember whether Laura had ever directly deceived him or whether she had simply allowed him to deceive himself. He'd assumed that she needed this time with her sister each summer, that she never asked him to come along, given his opinion of Joyce. He had considered a kindness. A month one year, Trevor said, 6 weeks the next. I painted her every minute I could and kept at it when she was gone.
There's another part in this where I think that Martin says she wasn't what you'd call a beautiful woman, and I loved Trevor's response.
Yeah, he says, no, she wasn't what you'd call. Or no, he says, she was what you'd call a beautiful woman. It wasn't,
I like that very much. You have, you know, a wonderful way with subtleties in here. And to me, there's a linking in this book. It's that so many people here suffer from self-deception.
Right.
The nun at the beginning of the story and the horse child. There's another part in here where he says, I'm no longer a gaffer. I'm now a DP.
Right.
I see your movie. Using your movie, script writing skills to good effect.
Yeah.
Later, the housewife who leaves home to go across the country, even the little boy in the concluding story.
Right.
Self-deception, I think, being perhaps endemic to the human condition.
I think so. Sure. We all have. We all have myriad reasons for lying to ourselves, and the lies that we tell ourselves are often so much more costly than the lies that other people tell us.
We're talking to the novelist and short story writer Richard Russo in this hour of The Connection. The number to call to get in on the conversation is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And let's take a call from Al, who's calling from Londonderry, New Hampshire.
Hello.
Hello, Al.
Hi, Al.
Hi, Mr. Russo.
Yes, hi.
I was up last night reading a new collection of short stories, and I was struck that there really isn't much difference in the kinds of people you're talking about in these stories from what you did in your previous novels. There's certainly the kinds of people that seem fully realized and very curious in terms of being the kind of character that you feel like you would like to meet walking down the street and know more about.
Right.
Apropos of this, I mean, this is one of the reasons whenever any of your works come out, I have to rush to the bookstore to get it. But I'm curious to know, because it seems like in all your stories you sort of end with your protagonist or your character still in the middle of their lives, and I'm wondering if you're kicking in the back of your mind, returning to the stories of any of your previous characters, and following up somehow in the way like Updike did with his Harry Angstrom,
right?
In terms of exploring other issues as it affects their lives. I think I don't know, you know, if you've come to that sort of realization about the kind of life you've given, like Miles Roby, in the mind of some of your readers.
Right, right. One of the nicest things that readers tell me is that they continue to live with these characters for a while after they put the book down, and then they have questions about them. What's going on with Miles now? They'll often have questions about some of my characters that even I don't have the answers to. There are all sorts of reasons to revisit characters. Most of them, however, are bad. The only real reason to revisit a character is that character's story is genuinely, legitimately ongoing and necessary. In addition to that, though, there are also other economic reasons. I know after the movie of Nobody's Fool came out, my agent was telling me, you've got to have another Sully story in there somewhere, haven't you? Because that would have been a good time to come with a sequel to that novel. The only problem was that I had resolved Sully's story to the point that I would have had to invent another whole crisis or dramatic circumstance for him to inhabit. Sometimes even great writers revisit great characters to not such great effect. You think of Mark Twain in his later years revisiting Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn, and you think, gosh, it was nice to see them again, but they didn't seem to have a real story to inhabit the way Huck inhabits that novel so completely. That said, I do sometimes feel the impulse to go back to characters. I'm feeling that impulse rather strongly right now, not in the book that I'm working on, but perhaps the next book, to revisit, and this may surprise you, to revisit Miss Burrell from Nobody's Fool, who now has to be very elderly indeed. She was already in her 80s when I wrote that novel, but when the novel concluded and Sully's story concluded, Miss Burrell was kind of left up in the air at the end of that book. Her son had left town with the money, so I'd like to look in on her again and see what's happened to her.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, she was one of the characters I was going to suggest.
Sully's
son and grandsons.
Thank you, Al. Yes, I think that they're... I'm not sure that Sully would be the main character, but I think Miss Burrell needs a visit. And I think that may be the next book after the one that I'm writing
now. And I wonder how his son is doing.
So do I.
Okay, Al, you may get the chance to find out.
Is he reconciled with his wife?
You'll have to wait and see. Thank you very much for calling, Al. Meadow is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. We're speaking with the novelist and short story writer Richard Russo in this hour of The Connection. The number to call is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Meadow is calling from Providence, Rhode Island.
Hello, Professor Russo. This is Meadow, a former student of yours.
Could this be
College.
Meadow Dibble?
This is Meadow Dibble James.
Is it still
Meadow?
Is it the former Meadow Dibble, now Meadow Dibble James?
That's correct.
Meadow, how are you?
I'm very well, and you seem to be doing very well. Congratulations. Yes.
Thank you so much.
Listen, I'm calling because as a student of yours, you always used to tell us to write what you know. And my question to you is, as you've become increasingly successful and sort of moved out of small-town life, has it become harder for you to put yourself back into that state of mind to write a novel such as Empire Falls, in which you really explore sort of that deeper I do, of course, realize that this novel has had great success. So apparently that's working. But just in terms of your own feelings for the characters and your approach to writing, has that changed?
No, it's pretty much the same. I think that what has to happen with a writer, in mid-career, as I now am, I was a much younger man, Meadow, when you knew me. And one of the things that has to happen with any writer in mid or even mid to late career is that what you know had better be growing. It's true that writers should write what they know. It's pretty important to expand what it is that you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's still very easy for me to return to that which I know best. And I think that most of us, what we know best is what we knew when we were young. That the first world that we inhabit remains very vivid, and it's always easy to return to. And in some ways, I think the older you get, the easier it is to return to it. We've all heard of elderly people. We all know elderly people for whom their childhood becomes increasingly vivid. Their memory becomes increasingly vivid the older they get, and as they're putting a kind putting their lives, as they think about their lives, into a kind of shape. It's necessary to return. And I don't find returning to the kind of world that I grew up in to be difficult at all. On the other hand, I'm very aware of the fact that as now a mid-career writer, that there has to be something besides autobiography. And so I find myself wanting to learn all sorts of things that I don't know enough about in order to write the next book. I may need to know about law, I may need to know about real estate, I may need to know about, you know, cinematography, I may need to know all sorts of things. And so, yes, write what you know, but make sure that you know enough and find out what you don't know.
Sure.
So, Meadow, I guess school hasn't continued. You could continue. Are you writing yourself?
I'm writing in French at the moment. If I come up with anything in English, I'll be sure to send it to Rick.
No, that's congratulations,
Meadow.
Writing in
connaît.
French, I can't do that.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good luck.
Adam is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. The number to call to speak to short story writer Rick Russo is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Hello, Adam.
Hey, how are you?
Calling from Nashville, Tennessee, are you?
Yes, I am. Mr. Russo, first of all, I wanted to tell you I just got back from vacation and had Straight Man as a companion. I thought it was just a terrific book. Devereaux's voice, that combination of kind of acerbic wit and forgiveness was just kind of a marvel, and I wished it would just continue.
Thank you, Adam.
I also read The Horse Child a few weeks ago and loved it and was very curious. I have a couple of questions, which is that in a lot of ways, like Richard Ford, you're obviously a novelist trafficking in the short form, and I'm curious about the pains of drafting the different forms. What I mean is, what is the process for you of drafting a short story, and what are its particular pitfalls and struggles versus a novel? I mean, to give you what I think is a great example, I know Walker Percy used to draft a novel and then start over from the beginning and redraft it, which sounds like an exercise in masochism.
Yeah.
But then, as well, my next question is, who do you read in the short form? Who do you particularly like? And then who do you read in the long form?
Okay, thanks. But let's go to the first part of that.
Sure.
Adam?
Yeah. The novel is a much more convenient form given you know, my own predilections and personality, because I'm naturally expansive as a writer. And I don't do what Percy did. I actually tend to write... in the novel form, I'll write 75 or 100 pages and realize I've made some sort of mistake that requires me to go back and start over again, and then I'll rewrite that and get up to another point where I realize, oh, here's the first page of the novel right here, and then go back and start again. And so it's accretion. And for me, writing the novel, I think the simplest philosophical thing that I can say about novel writing is that it is an act of faith, for me at least, because I don't know where I'm going. I just have to have faith that I'm going somewhere. And, you know, the pages pile up, and that's reassuring. And eventually you have, you know, a book, and then maybe you can even make it into a good book. But the act of writing a short story is an exercise in control. It's not an exercise in faith at all, because if it's going to be short, you're going to get a draft probably in 10 days. And you may continue to work on it if it seems that the story is working. You may continue to work on it for weeks or months, but chances are within 10 days you know whether you have something or not.
Right.
And so really the trick in the short story is to exercise control, to see it in terms of structure. In The Horse Child, for instance, there's in this novel, there's it's a fairly long story and a fairly complex story, but it's a fairly simple structure.
Right.
It's in a set of threes all the way through. The sister Ursula tells part of the story, and then she comes into talk with the professor the second part is that the story is workshopped with the students, and then she comes and talks to the professor in private. That happens three times in the story.
Right? I love sisters.
Well, that's a story in which structure is controlling to a certain extent what's happening in the story.
Sure.
The same. That's a very obvious structural device to use. Well, short stories are like that. I mean, you have to impose a kind of structure on them, and you have to impose a kind of control that I wouldn't dream of imposing upon a novel. Although some people have said that I should, but.
Does that answer your question, Adam?
Yes, thank you very much.
All right, thank you for calling. We're talking in this hour of The Connection with Richard Russo. Last year he won the Pulitzer for his novel Empire Falls. We're talking about the short form. Richard Russo's new book is a collection of short stories called The Whore's Child. The number to call to get in on the conversation is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jackie Leiden, and this is The Connection from National Public Radio.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From Boston University.
I'm Jackie Leiden, sitting in for Dick Gordon, and this is The Connection from NPR. My guest in this hour is author Richard Russo, who's just come out with his first short story collection. It's called The Whore's Child. Of course, he's more well-known for his very long, very complex novels, for which he has won the Pulitzer Prize. Let's read another story from this collection, Richard, if you would, please. This one's
sure.
Called, we were talking during the break, this is Joyride, and I have to say, this was one of my favorites in this collection. This involves a young boy
good.
And his mother and their journey west. You take it from there.
Okay. Yeah, John, the point of view character here, is a boy, and his mother packs him in the car one morning without much warning, having packed very little. And they blow town to get away from her husband, his father, to lose him, as she says, and lose him good. Blowing town was my mother's idea, but right then it seemed like the answer to my prayers, for I had fallen in with bad companions and was trying to impress them by acting crazier than they were. Craziness is something they understood and apparently admired, which was a revelation to me. Whenever I behaved like a lunatic, they clapped me on the back and congratulated me, and I liked their approval. These were the same young thugs, after all, who'd cornered me in the men's room back in the fall, two of them pinning me against the wall, while a third peed on my chinos, turning them dark brown at the crotch and down both inseams. And then, for the rest of the morning, I was pointed out in the halls as a seventh grader who still wet his pants. To be admitted into their fraternity was more than just gratifying. These boys had taught me a deep human truth, that it was far better to be admired than peed upon. Although not that much better, as I learned over the long winter months, my strategy had been to ingratiate myself further by performing small acts of insanity designed to capture their imaginations. One Monday during fourth period, having forgotten my lunch money, I dined exclusively on ketchup packets, consuming a whole tub of them for the entertainment of my lunch table. "You are one crazy little bastard, Durnbow," said the boy who had peed on my chinos, and the admiration I heard in his voice got me through a long diuretic afternoon. To ensure that everyone understood that I was no flash in the pan, I repeated the performance the following week, this time with mustard, to even more disastrous intestinal consequence. Gaining entrance to the dubious society proved disappointing, though of course I was unable to admit this even to myself. No group in my junior high school had a wilder reputation than my new friends, but as far as I could tell, it was largely unearned. They had let on, and of course it was believed, that during the summer they had stolen a car and taken a joyride down the coast to Old Orchard Beach, where they had drunk beer and met some high school girls who had come across, and they'd spent all night on the beach. Well, this was exactly the kind of adventure I feared and longed for. I hadn't hung out with my new friends very long, however, before I began doubting that the episode had ever happened. Either they had lied, or they had only had this one joyride in them. I was beginning to suspect that the most daring act they'd ever performed was peeing on my chinos back in October. By now they seemed to look to me for inspiration, and increasingly I was responsible for the execution as well. I not only had to conceive of the smoke bomb in the tailpipe, but I also had to buy it with my own money and put it there. I was given to understand that it wasn't cowardice that infected my companions, but rather that they had records from their many run-ins with the cops. One more bust would land them in reform school, whereas I had years of credit stored up as a result of having been such a little pussy for so long. They were therefore determined that we should get on equal terms. Once we were all equally at risk, they'd start kicking ass again. Until then, we'd restrict ourselves to what we called small, random acts of senselessness. The lighted M80 shoved through the mail slot, the burning bag of fresh dog shit on the welcome mat, sugar in the neighbor's gasoline tank. But these were not what had me looking for an escape. The day before, on an impulse that frightened me into something like wakefulness, I had picked up a stone and thrown it, hard as I could, at a mangy dog that had just lifted its leg to pee on the tire of a parked car. My intention had been, I thought, to scare the animal off, to teach it caution. But I knew the moment that I released it that the stone was too heavy. And I knew the moment that I released it that it would neither miss the dog nor nick it on the flank. Suddenly aware of us, the animal put its hind leg back down and turned, just in time to catch the stone right between the eyes, dropping without a sound. "Jesus, Durnbow," my companion said as one. By the time we ran, blood was oozing thickly through its fur.
This is the point of departure for this story, and it is a story about departures from what this little boy and his, well, he's not so little, he's 12.
Yeah.
And his mother are going to come to. And after we leave the town, it becomes his story of his perceptions of her. She's the wounded animal. And I You know, I was reminded a little bit of the beginning of This Boy's Life. I don't know if you've read that memoir
I'm
by Tobias
Wolff. Very, very fond of all of Tobias Wolff's work, including that memoir, yeah.
And, of course, that's a story that begins with a mother and a boy hauling ass out of town. But here, he's going to see that humiliation comes about. And once again, he can't do much about it. And are you looking at humiliation in this short story? Or are you trying to grapple with something else here?
Well, certainly humiliation is part of it, and probably not just in this story. The Horse Child is another story about terrible humiliation that a young girl has to endure really for the better part of a lifetime. In several of the stories in this book and also in Empire Falls, one of the things that is intriguing me, I suppose, in this part of my artistic life is why human beings find cruelty so damn satisfying. It has something to do with the irrational, and it's it seems to me kind of important to figure out, although I don't know if I'm making any progress other than kind of defining the questions or the way in which the question is stated. But it is for reasons that I'm not exactly sure I could articulate, a fascinating subject.
It is.
And it's explored in several of these stories and in the novels as well.
Well, perhaps because daily life becomes a struggle against that kind of condition.
Yeah.
Try not to be humiliated in some way. If you want to be humiliated, join us in this conversation.
Life is one long struggle for some form of dignity, isn't it?
1-800-423-8255 makes the connection. 1-800-423-TALK. Let's try and hear from another listener. Patience is calling from Ipswich, Massachusetts. Hello, Patience.
Hello. Mr. Ford, I greatly admire your
Mr. Russo, I think, yes. Well, you'll take a compliment by any name.
But I will pass on that compliment to Richard Ford, who lives just down the road from here.
He does, yes. Someone just mentioned him. Earlier caller just mentioned him.
Yeah.
I was obviously thinking of you. And your people and your novels become part of my life while I'm reading them. I just finished Nobody's Fool, mm-hmm. and loved Empire Falls. And I'm wondering, since you've said on this show, and since I've read stories about you elsewhere, that the novel is your natural medium, why did you write these short stories? I mean, what to impose this control on yourself? I'm just wondering why you did it.
Why do it, right?
Why would you do it if it's hard?
Why do
it?
Yeah.
That's
the answer. That's both the question and the answer. Yeah. There's a wonderful scene in John Steinbeck's Cannery Row in which Doc is trying to explain to some of the transient bums around that this experiment that keeps going wrong and he can't seem to quite figure out and he keeps after it and after it and after it and one of the bums looks at him and says, "Well, Doc, why don't you give up?" And the answer is because it's hard and because because you're stubborn and you think if you keep at it maybe it'll turn out all right. I do. I like the form despite the fact that it's not a natural for me. And I end up with stuff left over. As I said, there are three stories in this collection that were once part of novels of mine.
Yeah,
and Sister Ursula in the first story is a character that I absolutely loved, and I recognized she had no place in Straight Man, but I couldn't just let her go. She's one of my absolute favorite characters, so I just had to find a form for her to fit into.
She is such a striking character. She's the protagonist of the title story, and you put her in a writing class. I love that. And she's come to you, you know, in this story. Come to you, I'm saying.
Yeah,
come to the unnamed
narrator,
professor.
Yeah.
Yes, the narrator. What a great character. She is the queen of first lines. Talk more about where she came. Well, let's just read her first line. You go ahead and just the first line. I think the first thing she says, it's very short.
Yeah.
And the page is page three.
Yeah, she writes a number of first lines, and her first lines are all showstoppers. In the convent, Sister Ursula's first submission began, I was known as the whore's child.
Yeah, we don't need to go farther than that. We're running out of time on the show. Yeah. But, you know, what genesis for Sister Ursula?
Well, I have been interested in what was happening to nuns in the American Catholic Church and the Catholic Church in general for some time. It's just one more way in which the Church seems to me to be pretty misogynistic, and I don't think I'm the only Catholic or lapsed Catholic that has come to that conclusion. And you only have to look at the way elderly nuns are treated and compare it to the way elderly and retired priests are treated to know which is valued in the church. I did know at one point I was living, maybe it was when I was living in New Haven, there was a dying order of nuns that was housed in a dilapidated old house not far from where I lived, and we used to see them going by, mm-hmm. Driving by the house, and it seemed that these women had incredibly hard lives. They had been living very challenging lives, teaching or trying to teach, in some cases, students like me, so I know their lives were hard, I was just interested in looking into that, into the way lives of these women, especially in later life when they were sick and there was no one to take care of them.
Let's go to just one more call before we conclude. Sarah, calling from La Crosse, Wisconsin, just quickly.
Hello. Mr. Russo, I happened to hear you on Chapter a Day. That's how come I became your fan. They were reading Empire Falls.
Yes, I keep hearing about that. Yeah,
huh?
I keep hearing about that. That must have been a wonderful production. I've been traveling all over the country, and I can't tell you how many times I've had people tell me exactly what you're saying.
Well, anyway, and I work with a disabled woman, and she isn't able to read, so I tell her the books I've read of yours, and we both laugh and laugh and laugh, and especially from Nobody's Fool, how do you think up these things so that poor little lady, they got killed by the cash register?
yeah, I'd love to know where these more morbid and... I don't know. It seemed to me a very just end. This is a woman who had spent her life putting money in a cash register. It seemed a perfect and fitting conclusion to a woman who had spent her life in exactly this posture. If you live your life with a cash register, you're going to die at least near one.
Do you think there'll be another collection of short stories somewhere in the future for you?
I suspect so, but I think it'll probably be another good decade because I have to wait for other novels to yank these stories out of.
All right. Well, we'll have to treasure this one. Thanks so much. It's been fun having you on the show.
Thank you, Jackie.
My guest is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author Richard Russo. His novels are Mohawk, The Risk Pool, Nobody's Fool, Straight Man, and Empire Falls. His new collection of short stories is The Whore's Child. He also wrote the introduction to The Collected Stories of Richard Yates, which was released this spring, and he'll be reading tonight at the Coolidge Corner Theater in Brookline, Massachusetts, at 6 o'clock. Connection listeners, you can continue this conversation on our website, theconnection.org. The show is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Allison McAdam, Lindsay Miller, Tara Murphy, Christina Russo, and Doug Shugarts. Our senior producer is Graham Smith. I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be.